accession number 8837, row number 3.
Edgewinter, reel 3.
The company second in command, one Derek Webster, was not so fortunate. He was relying on a company on his right to a company of the another battalion on his right to tell him when to withdraw, and in the confusion that ensued, he failed to be taught to be warned. When eventually he discovered that he was alone and that the rest of the brigade had left, he missed the train. Undeterred by himself, he started to walk down the railway line when he came upon one of these four-wheeled trucks with a lever which by depressing up and down with a chap on either end, the bar lever, you could propel this vehicle. The sort of truck that you see in a cartoon. And between them, they managed to propel this thing and eventually arrived some 3 or 4 hours later in Donbass. From Donbass, we were told that we would move. The railway to Arnlesnes had been cut by enemy aircraft. So we would have to use transport to get to Arnlesnes. There were three Norwegian lorries driven by Norwegian soldiers who would take us to Arnlesnes, some 40 to 50 miles. Obviously, this wasn't going to take the whole battalion or the whole brigade. So we started to march, and gradually the lorries returned, picking up a load every time they returned. As the day wore on, the lorries got fewer and fewer. In fact, by the end, only one was still in working order. The march, apart from German Air Force strafing, was uneventful, but delayed considerably by the strafing. As soon as they could reload and come back, they strafed the whole way.
You mean the lorries had broken down, had they?
The lorries, too, were subject to strafing. And it was only one that survived to the end. And the battalion was marching down the road, the lorry taking a load, and then it came back, meeting the advancing troops, taking another load, and the balance carried on, and so on, in a shuttle service. The majority of the battalion marched probably about getting on for 20-odd miles before the final chap was picked up in the lorry and transported to Arnlesnes. Where we arrived, by the time I arrived, it was dark, and we moved down to the quay just in time for a really splendid sight of a naval cruiser coming in to the jetty in a wonderful flourish, all engines hard astern, rudder far over, and landing with a bang against the quay. It was the quickest and slickest docking I've ever seen. This was Galatea. So on we trooped. We were taken by Galatea, and again subjected to bombing, aerial bombing, in the Loch, in the fjord, but managed to survive, and some 20 or 24 hours later arrived at Scapa Flow, where we transferred to the troop transports.
What equipment did you bring back with you?
We brought back with us our personal arms, such ammunition as survived. The more enthusiastic their large packs, the less enthusiastic their small packs, and that was about it, the sum total.
Now, you said that you had lost a lot of ammunition in the ship making the crossing. Did you find your activities much hampered by shortage of ammunition?
No. I'm afraid I gave you the wrong impression. What I meant was that the ammunition for the artillery had been on a ship which sank. We did not lose any ammunition at all, but we were restricted in as much as we had no transport. We could only take the ammunition which we could carry. We were carrying additional ammunition, but of course there is a limit to the individual load.
When you were making that journey, marching and by lorry from Donbass to Andal's Nest, were you suffering many casualties?
From the strafing, we had a few, yes. From the RAF strafing, the German strafing.
How were they dealt with? Did you have RAMC with you?
Not with the battalion. Those that could be carried were carried. There were no vehicles, you see, no ambulances. They were merely put on the next lorry, carried as far as the next lorry and placed on it, such casualties as we had. The majority of them were walking wounded, so it wasn't too difficult. I mean, the strafing only got gunshot wounds in arms, legs, various parts of the body, but didn't totally incapacitate.
But was there anybody there with medical expertise to see to them?
There was the battalion medical orderly, but there was no I don't remember a field ambulance. There must have been, but I don't remember seeing it.
Did you get any impression of German casualties?
Not a real one. I know we inflicted casualties, or I'm pretty certain we did, but I've no idea of the severity or otherwise.
Did you see much of the Norwegian army?
Very little. There were the drivers, one or two officers at Andal's Nest, at the port, the dockside. But otherwise, I never made contact with them. But remember, I was not the KOILI were the forward troops. But I don't think they did either. I think we were too late. The whole brigade was too late.
So you didn't see any Norwegian units?
Not a unit, no.
What did the demeanour of the few Norwegian troops that you saw seem to be?
Very friendly, very bitter, and very determined.
What were they bitter about?
They were bitter about the invasion of their land and the casualties that and losses to their own side which they'd had. They were bitter against the Germans.
Did they speak to you in English?
Yes. Yes, they had to. No decent Yorkshire soldier speaks any language other than English. They had to speak in English. I don't think anybody knew Norwegian.
Was there any fraternization?
There were too few of them, and the opportunities were too sparse to describe it as fraternization. There was the normal comradeship of a lorry driver to the chap passing. But there were too few of them, and the opportunities were not opportune for social engagements.
What about Norwegian civilians? Did you see or have much contact
with them? Only personally met two. They were the, I suppose, the proprietor of a guest house or small hotel. Their English was limited and my Norwegian was nil, but they were very amiable. The rest of Donbass, you see, had really evacuated it, having because of the air raids. There's only this chap in this guest house, which was out of town on the slopes of the hills and had escaped the bomb damage. Otherwise, you see, we didn't see the civilians.
Was it possible to tell what the attitude of the civilians was towards you and towards what was going on?
It wasn't possible because, as I say, I only met two and I couldn't talk to them. They were friendly, amiable, and offered me refreshment.
What about discipline of the troops? Did you have any discipline problems in Norway?
No, you see, the time was so short, the action so fast, that the chap hadn't time to step out of line. It's only when a chap has time to sit and think and become idle that trouble starts. But, I mean, things move so quickly. That there was no quay, there wasn't time for anybody to.
What about the behaviour of the troops with regard to Norwegian property? Did they respect Norwegian property or not?
Yes. There wasn't much Norwegian property to respect, but such as we found, they were treated it perfectly normally. I remember they took advantage of a wood supply to light a fire in a chap's wooden stove and cook food, but other than that they left the houses as they were, and the houses had been evacuated with all the furniture and most of the ornaments and bits and pieces still in statue.
Did anybody fall sick in Norway?
Not that I'm aware of. This, you mean sick as opposed to a battle casualty?
Yes.
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, obviously somebody must have got a cold or something.
What was the weather like whilst you were there?
Bitterly cold at night. Even these enormous issue poshteens worn over a greatcoat had little effect on keeping the cold out. Of course, the snow was on the ground, although the rivers had had thawed and were running. By day, for a short period, say from about 11:30 to 2:00, the sun was glorious, and if you were digging or making a sanger, you could work in shirt sleeves. And then, the second the sun went down, it got absolutely bitter. It really was cold. Coldest I've ever known. I think it was quite normal for Norwegians, but...
You said that the sheepskin saved your lives.
They did. Without them, I would have been rigid. But even with the sheepskin worn on top of my greatcoat, it still was bitterly, intensely cold. But without them, I think I'd have just been rigid like something out of a deep freeze.
So there was no problem with frostbite?
No, there wasn't. Not that I heard of.
Did it snow whilst you were there?
This was the remains of the winter snows. It was, of course, spring. The end of April, you see, still spring. We didn't have any snow, but it was... And I suppose the sun was out for such a short time that not a great deal thawed before it started to get cold again each day.
What was the morale of the troops like in Norway?
On the whole, the morale was all right. As usual, soldiers were ticking, but then any soldier ticks if you tell him he's got to march a long way carrying a lot of kit. One fully understands that. And as it was all done on foot, there were certain adverse remarks about the lack of air support. But then if we hadn't any airplanes, that answered that question. But they did feel slightly let down that they should be subjected to all this air attack, and we never saw one Allied plane. One must bear in mind that this was the first time that the battalion had suffered any air attack. Up till then, France in 39 and the Maginot Line and those sort of places, there had been no insight as to what went on.
What about when you all got back to Scotland and Norway had been more or less abandoned? Was there a sense of depression about that?
Not depression for the survivors. You see, the battalion arrived back in Scotland less than 50% of its strength when it set out for Norway. We were only 300 and something strong when we got back. There'd been heavy casualties, and there'd also been losses. There were chaps who walked into Sweden and then came back that way. There were chaps who marched into, who walked to the coast, and there was one pair that managed to talk a Norwegian fisherman into bringing them across the North Sea in a boat. And the commanding officer, in fact, went to Sweden. He didn't come back with the battalion because he was cut off. So in fact there were only about 40% of the strength that set foot for Norway returned. There was great relief. I don't think they were depressed. I think it was more relief. And then, of course, we were expecting to refit, re-kit, get reinforced, and go back to France. And then, you see, just at that moment, of course, the battle in France opened. So he never returned. But that, I mean, that was the luck of the draw. We were always poised on the brink of returning to France.
What do you think were the lessons of the Norwegian campaign?
The absence of support. There's no doubt that had the brigade had support, its supporting arms, and if it had had any aircraft as well, any air support as well, we'd have been there now. But because the situation demanded it, the only means of transport to Norway couldn't carry the transport and the supporting arms, we went without them and paid the penalty.
Would it have made much difference, do you think, if a stand had been made not so far south down the valley?
No. I don't think so. In fact, it was a better place to make a stand. It was a narrower bit of valley. Therefore, easier to defend. No, I don't think so.
Was there any tendency on the part of either officers or men to cast blame for what had happened?
I don't. Not after the initial reaction of this concentrated withdrawal. A withdrawal is never a nice thing to happen, and it doesn't contribute in any way to morale. In fact, quite the reverse. And to have your first taste of warfare and action to consist of a series of withdrawals is never the best thing. But I don't think there was any great commiseration. Especially when afterwards one learnt more facts as to and the circumstances arising.
When did that happen?
Oh, in the next 3 or 4 months, you know, when we heard about Sickleforce and General Carpenter Wirt and all the full